You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I'd like to give all of you a little bit of context before we begin for the purpose of today's session. All of you who are here clearly know that there's going to be a referendum on September 18th, a very historic referendum in the larger context, not just the United Kingdom, but we think, and this will be the focus of the discussion today internationally, on the prospective independence of Scotland and then the dissolution, essentially, of one of the oldest political unions globally, the Union of the United Kingdom. And in many respects, as we also know in the United States, we tend not to pay attention to these kinds of things until they're just about to happen. So we've had a lot of deliberations around the think tank world, whether we should actually be having meetings like this 2 weeks before the referendum. August, you know, of course, is not the best time to have meetings, but we actually decided that we'd try to get started a little earlier because in spite of the actual resounding lack of attention to this topic in most of the US media, there's been a flurry of activity, obviously, in the United Kingdom. In February, there was a huge series of articles in the Financial Times. The political campaign, both in favour of a yes vote in the referendum and against a yes vote, the no campaign in the United Kingdom is actually picking up. There's been lots of controversial statements and presentations. And right now, as we speak, it's also Tartan Week, as it used to be called, and also Scotland Week in New York. So for those of you who follow fashion trends and business, the First Minister of Scotland, Alex Salmond, is currently in the other great city of the United States in New York, touting up business there for Scotland. And in fact, he was actually here in this very auditorium exactly a year ago, putting out the case very cogently, very well-argued case for independence. There was a rather a large audience. And for those of you who weren't there, you can go back again to the Brookings website and to see the case that Alex Salmond made. So now we're going to do an event with the counter-argument, having a very distinguished individual in his own right, with obviously a stake in this issue coming directly from Scotland, Lord George Robertson. Who has been distinguished not just in his political career in the United Kingdom as an MP for Scotland for many years, as the UK Defence Secretary, and also as the NATO Secretary General for the period from 1999 to 2004. And security is one of the issues that, of course, is at the top of the debate and some of the attention that's been paid to the Scottish referendum, what will be the future, for example, of the UK Trident submarine capacity. There are many different issues on the table. Many of you might have seen Lord Robertson's op-ed in the Washington Post on this topic, which is one of the first forays into this issue. So we're trying to provide as much of a balance as possible, at least in the early stage of this debate. We hope we'll have a few more of these kinds of meetings as we move forward towards September 18th. We also hope that the numbers of you might swell, although we do think it's the rain that's kind of put people off coming. I also want to give a very personal thanks to Lord Robertson. He knows what I'm going to say now here, because I wouldn't actually be here if it wasn't for this gentleman here. When he was the MP for Hamilton back in the 1980s, he's a graduate of Dundee University when Dundee University was first signed up, but it used to be part of St Andrews University where I was an undergraduate. And I was a bit lost at the end of my first year, wondering if I'd actually made the right choices in terms of my decisions, in terms of picking my subject to study. And I went into our career services asking if they could give me any help, and they gave me the address to write to. This is the days before computers. This was a handwritten note to George Robertson, MP, who was also at that time, I think, on the British-Russia, there was a commission committee that also dealt with Russia. And I wrote him a very long, probably completely incoherent letter, a bit like my opening statement here. And he very kindly wrote back to me and said he thought I'd made the right decisions and he was some advice for the future. So here I am. Thank you to Lord George Robertson. So hopefully he can give us all the similar kind of wise perspective on what's going on with the Scottish referendum and really the larger implications of this internationally, not just for the United Kingdom. And then I'm going to hand over to Thomas Wright, my colleague here from the Brookings Institution, who's going to have a conversation with Lord Robertson and then hand it over to you to also ask questions. So without any further ado, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Fiona, and I'm sure our grateful nation is appreciative of the letter that I sent you back and kept you here and done a great job here too. And I'd just like to thank the United States of America for providing such wonderfully Scottish weather to make me feel at home, and such a wonderful warm welcome at Dulles Airport last night, so that Malcolm Rifkind, another former Secretary of State for Defence, and I stood for an hour and a half in line waiting to be interrogated by the U.S. Immigration Service. This was deeply impressive, I have to tell you, to the Brits who were also standing in line in seeing us in solidarity with their plight as we waited for this football crowd to disperse eventually. But it's interesting that the leader of the Better Together campaign, I think, is in Washington this week, and the First Minister of Scotland is in New York. So we're making our pitch about an issue of some significance to our country in the United States. But what I want to do tonight is to concentrate on the geopolitical consequences of this proposition that Scotland should become an independent country. I think there's a tendency sometimes for us to sit inside our own electoral bubble, and the debate is reaching almost fever pitch inside Scotland at the present moment. But the rest of the world, I think, as Fiona said, is only gradually catching up, and I don't think has yet caught up with the full and dramatic implications of what is going on. You know, we are in 2014, 100 years on from the start of what is known as the Great War, and we again are living in turbulent and unstable times. The crises in Ukraine and Syria, in the East China Sea and in Africa are only the start of a list of agonies affecting the stability of the world today. And rarely has there been a time when the unity and solidarity of the ordered, value-subscribing world has been more required. That world is often referred to as the West, both by friends and by enemies. But it is recognisable by the countries who have sustainable democratic structures, the rule of law, freedom of expression, and open economies. However imperfect at times, the nations who make up the membership of NATO and the European Union do form an island of predictability and solidity in what has become a tempestuous and fragile world. The United Kingdom, my country, is still a major power in the world. Both militarily and diplomatically, it has weight and it has influence. In the United Nations and in the European Union, in NATO, the IMF, the OSCE, the WTO, and many more organisations, we are still listened to with authority and with respect. Whatever our occasional faults, we're still one of the anchors of the Western world. Our diplomatic outreach is significant, and our aid budget is one of the biggest in the world, and it's still rising. In the geopolitics of today, that anchor is important and it is necessary. Our military is still formidable and a credible force for deterrence against the aggression and territorial intimidation which has now returned to haunt us. And Britain's nuclear missile submarines, continuously at sea, are a crucial part of NATO's historic role in deterring military adventurism. So who would cheer loudest on the 19th of September, less than 6 months away from now, if 4 million Scottish voters decided, say narrowly but decisively, to break the United Kingdom in two? Not the nearly half of the Scottish population who might oppose separation. Not the English who would find themselves in a country that is minus a third of its landmass, without 10% of its GNP, and losing 5 million of its population. And this would be, for them, a very diminished country whose global position would be open to question. Not the Northern Irish, who would see a reappearance of old demons, nor the Welsh, whose desire for more devolution inside the continuing United Kingdom is still increasing. The loudest cheers for the breakup of Britain would be from our adversaries and from our enemies. For the second military power in the West to shatter this year would be cataclysmic in geopolitical terms. If the United Kingdom was to face a split at this of all times and find itself embroiled for several years in a torrid, complex, difficult and debilitating divorce, it would rob the West of a serious partner just when solidity and cool nerves are going to be vital. Nobody should underestimate the effect all of that would have on existing global balances, and the forces of darkness would simply love it. The new Scottish state, as seen by the present separatist government, would add to the turmoil and the disruption of the breakup by adopting a profoundly inward-gazing security policy. According to the Scottish Government's 670-page white paper on independence, they would have a subscale military with no expeditionary capability, no nuclear-powered or ballistic missile submarines, and a security policy modelled on Ireland and on Austria. And unpicking the UK military would be a depressing and damaging exercise, and one that would be fraught with argument and with dissension. Although the Scottish National Party say that they like to compare Scotland with Denmark and Norway, they actually plan in their white paper to spend less than them. And these countries, of course, have over many years reached a steady developed state. They're not starting with a blank sheet of paper. There is as well an SNP aspiration for the separate Scottish state to join NATO. But the SNP has been for all its history bitterly opposed to NATO. The conversion came by a very slim internal majority just as the referendum campaign started, and in my view still lacks credibility. That credibility is magnified by the assertion that they will only countenance membership so long as the United Kingdom's independent deterrent submarines are expelled from their Scottish base, and they have a written constitution prohibiting all nuclear-carrying and nuclear-powered vessels from Scottish land and Scottish waters. Since the United States of America does not ever declare whether its ships are carrying nuclear weapons, that would automatically, by definition, exclude any ship of the United States Navy from entering Scottish waters. How could that possibly, that condition possibly, be acceptable to the other 28 members of the alliance? It is one thing to unilaterally disarm yourself, but when you choose to unilaterally disarm your neighbour, then you're playing with fire. And given that NATO's strategic concept explicitly states that so long as nuclear weapons exist, NATO will be a nuclear alliance, it's difficult to see the NATO-friendly policy as more than an electoral fix, but yet one that is loaded with ominous overtones for Western deterrence. But the geostrategic consequences don't stop with what happens in the United Kingdom on the 19th of September. The ripple effects will go much wider than our own shores. The United Kingdom is not alone in having separatist movements. In Spain, both Catalonia and the Basque Country have declared that they want independence. Catalonia, where 1.5 million people marched in the streets demanding independence. And remember that the Scottish National Party have never had more than 10,000 people at any demonstration. But Catalonia says that it will have its referendum on independence from Spain, even if it's in breach of the constitution of its country. The Basque extremists have only in the recent past backed away from terrorism, but they are watching Catalonia and Scotland with quite undisguised interest. Then there's Belgium, a country at the moment which is held together by a thread. The Flemish nationalists see Scotland as breaking the mould. We are next if Scotland breaks free and becomes a member of the European Union, they quite openly say. And as if to underline what this means for Europe, despite its manifest claim to nationhood, Kosovo still finds itself unrecognised by a handful of European Union countries, worried about the implications of breakaway for their own separatist movements. So I contend that it is far from scaremongering to use the term Balkanisation to predict what might happen if Scotland was to break from its 300-year-old union. The fragmentation of Europe starting on the centenary of the outbreak of the First World War would be both an irony and a tragedy with incalculable consequences. You know, there is some significance in all of we Scots speaking here in Washington and in New York and the major cities of the United States of America, because the possible independence of Scotland maybe resonates with some who were involved in great battles of the past over here. And some people with no real grasp of history make a tortured comparison with the American bid for independence from Britain in the 1770s. Something that was pioneered by the Scots, of course, who had a lot to do with that. Indeed, I come from, my title is Lord Robertson of Port Ellen. Port Ellen is a tiny village of 300 people on the west coast of Scotland, best known for the fact that it has 8 malt Scotch whisky distilleries on it. In 1734, a man called Alexander MacDougall was born just outside of the village of Port Ellen. He became a ship's captain, came to the the American colonies at that time, led the revolt in New York, was imprisoned by the British, became a hero at the time, chaired the great meeting in the fields, was the colonel of the 1st New York Regiment. The following year, he was made a brigadier general in George Washington's forces, and the year after that was made a major general, the top rank in the Revolutionary Army at that time. During the War of Independence, he commanded at West Point, fought in 2 of the great battles, was eventually elected to be a member of the Continental Congress, and quite remarkably, when the Continental Congress decided it could not run this new country with a committee structure, created 4 departments of state with 4 secretaries, a secretary of finance, a secretary of state, a secretary of war for the army, and the minister of marine for the navy. And Alexander MacDougall, the boy from Port Ellen, was appointed the very first minister of the marine of the United States. And in the brief period that he held that office, before he resigned, saying that he wanted to fight in the war and he wanted to be continue to be a general, he appointed John Paul Jones, another Scotsman, to be the commander of the United States Navy as well. He then saved America from the military coup that was on the cards at the end of the Revolutionary War, since the states would not pay the soldiers. He and Alexander Hamilton brokered the deal that prevented a military takeover, went back to New York and was appointed first president of the first cash bank in America, the Bank of New York. The boy from Port Ellen died at the age of 54, and we have a memorial now to him just outside that village. So it resonates a little bit coming here, especially to Washington, to do that. But another Scot, Sir Sean Connery, who is an independent supporting Scotsman who's domiciled for the moment in the Bahamas, was recently urging Americans to support the Scottish independence campaign. But if he and others who make this facile comparison understood the history of this country, they might look more relevantly at the Civil War, where hundreds of thousands of Americans perished in a war to keep the new Union together. To Lincoln and his compatriots, the Union was so precious, so important, and its integrity so valuable that rivers of blood would be spilt to keep it together. But all the time, let us remember, Scotland is not a colony. It is not oppressed. It's not discriminated against. It isn't disadvantaged. Indeed, it's the second most prosperous part of the United Kingdom outside of London and the southeast of England. And that's largely because we are part of the United Kingdom. We're not persecuted. Scots are prominent, some would say dominant, at every level in Scottish life, in British life. We speak the same language. We enjoy the same currency, the same central bank, the same regulatory system, the same public service broadcaster, and much, much more. And at the same time as all of that, we have in Scotland a legislative parliament which has full powers on health, education, transport, the legal system, local administration, agriculture, land, tourism, and practically every other domestic field. We have indeed, as Scots, got the best of both worlds. So what possible justification should there be for breaking up the United Kingdom? What could possibly justify giving the dictators, the persecutors, the oppressors, the annexers, the aggressors, and the adventurers across the planet the biggest pre-Christmas present of their lives by tearing the United Kingdom apart? As I said at the beginning, I fear from time to time that we Scots are living in a veritable bubble in this debate, and outside of that increasingly fractious bubble, we're losing sight of the fact that our decision on the 18th of September will have much wider and bigger implications than any of us yet grasp. So in the next few months, the people of Scotland have to properly and soberly examine the impact of their decision on the stability of the world. And in that time, the rest of the ordered world needs to tell us that it actually cares. Thank you very much for your attention.
Lord Robertson, thank you very much for those remarks. I'll allow you to be mic'd up and I'll just introduce myself to the audience. I'm Tom Wright. I'm a fellow here at Brookings with the Project on International Order and Strategy. I'd like to start with a comment you made about what possible justification is there for Scottish independence, because as you sort of refer to, in Catalonia, there's a long history, obviously, of tension between Catalonia and the central government in Madrid that goes right back to the Civil War. In other cases, there was independence involved. Colonies that saw themselves as somewhat oppressed. But it's very different in Scotland. I mean, Scotland has been an integral part of the UK for hundreds of years, and Scots, as you point out, have played even a disproportionate role in Britain's influence in the world, and originally in the Empire, and since then in the Cold War and afterwards. And so my question is, why do you think, I know you're on the pro-union side of the debate, but why do you think the Scottish people have been falling out of love with Great Britain over the last decade?
Well, I think it's important sometimes to try and understand your adversary. You know, in my time in defence and in NATO, I always try to put myself in the position of the people on the other side of the table. I was once a trade union negotiator, and it was a good technique to do that as well. So, you know, I've tried hard to understand the rationalisation for separation, and a lot of it has to do with emotion. I think a lot of it has to do with confusing the other parts of Britain solely with London. The campaign in Scotland is characterized by the nationalists, by the separatists, as being wholly negative on the no side. Very difficult to be positive when you're campaigning for a no vote, but actually the yes campaign has largely focused on negative criticism of the present government, as if, you know, you change the government by changing the country. You change the nature of the politics at a UK level by changing the constitution of the UK. But there has been this sort of build-up of feeling that London is filled with spivs and bonus-paying bankers, you know, and dictating to the rest of the country with housing bubbles and the rest of things. And there's a degree of resentment has built up over time on that. I think in the rest of the campaign, people will begin to focus on just what the disruption would be involved in doing it. But there is a degree of emotionalism around that is whipped up along with criticism of the government. One of the most successful slogans, it has to be said, of the yes side is a slogan that says no Tory governments ever. As if you change the whole nature of your country and go through the whole process of creating a separate state simply in order not to have a Conservative government. Now, it's a useful dishonest tactic to use, and perhaps they should remember the only party in Scotland ever to get a majority of votes in a general election was the Conservative and Unionist Party in 1955. When I was leader of the Scottish Labour Party, we got the highest proportion for the Labour Party that we'd ever had, and that was 46%. So, you know, it's sort of talking in terms of keeping out the Tories forever. This is not to be guaranteed.
Why do you think, though, that the idea of Britain and the sort of the pro, you know, Britain's contribution to the world doesn't resonate more, you know, in Scotland? Why has the No campaign been unable to connect on that emotional level? Because there's not a lack of history there. I mean, Britain obviously fought as a unified country in two world wars, in the Cold War, has a long sort of tradition going back. But it seems like that the No campaign, as someone mentioned to us here at Brookings a few months ago, has no song. You know, the yes side has a song and the emotion, but the no side doesn't. Why is there that disconnect?
Well, I'm not sure that's true. If you looked at the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games last year, the 2012 Olympic Games, you know, it was about the diversity of the United Kingdom. It was about the different elements that make up our multicultural, multinational society. It was, you know, it resonated with music and with drama, with the National Health Service, with the values that we stand for, you know. And when, you know, Andy Murray had the Union Jack flag wrapped around him and Chris Hoy, you know, the sense of Britishness was there. They were competing for Team GB. And even at the Sochi Winter Olympic Games, you know, where Britain did better than it's ever done at a Winter Olympics, you know, there were Scots there who were winning medals and were dressed in the Union Jack as well. But over the years, you know, because we are a conglomeration of different countries, each with its own identity, you know, there have been occasions when, you know, that identity has supplanted the overall identity that is there. You know, the English flag, the flag of St. George, is more in evidence now in England than it has been for many, many years, because England qualifies for the World Football Club when the Scottish team hasn't. The concept of England is, you know, has become a little more alive. So the diversity can be a strength, but it can also produce weaknesses as well.
Right. You laid out in your speech today and in articles earlier some of the detrimental consequences for the UK as a whole, but also for Scotland in the event of independence. Obviously, all of this will have to be resolved in a negotiation after a yes vote. And so London and Edinburgh will sit down and try to resolve it. The No campaign says that the SNP have misrepresented what Scotland will get out of such a negotiation, that Alex Salmond has been overpromising, and what he can deliver in any negotiation with the rest of the UK. If that is correct, and if the negotiated agreement between a newly Scotland post an independence vote and London is much worse than what the SNP now says it is, do you believe that the Scottish people ought to be given the opportunity in 2 years' time to vote on that negotiated agreement and to have the option of almost reversing any position that they would take in September? Or is September the 18th a point of no return? After that, the Scots are, everyone is basically bound into accepting to whatever negotiation would occur.
Well, the agreement that was signed by the British Prime Minister and by the First Minister of Scotland, the so-called Edinburgh Agreement, lays down that that the UK will accept the outcome of the referendum on the 18th of September. But I think you outline a really serious dilemma that people will have to face at the time. You know, the 670 pages of the White Paper, this huge tome that is being distributed at public expense, has no downsides, no risks, no possibles, and is therefore, you know, frankly, a prospectus that would never be acceptable if a company was being floated. It just makes a series of assertions without any qualification. And the fact is, and I've said this to so many people who at the moment seem puzzled, you vote yes, and then the negotiations take place. So you won't know whether you've got a currency union or not, what currency you're going to be using, whether you will be in the European Union, whether you will be in NATO, what will happen to British pension schemes, you know, what's going to happen to the regulatory framework for our huge financial services industry. And none of that will be known on the 18th of September. All of it will be the subject of negotiation. And indeed, some of it, some of the negotiations will not be led by the Scottish government because Scotland will not be a country at that point. So negotiations over EU membership and NATO membership and the like of it will actually be done by the UK government. But if Scotland has voted yes, what happens to ministers in the government, like the Chief Secretary of the Treasury, number two in the Treasury, who is an MP for the Highlands? You know, what's going to happen to members of Parliament who are presently in the Westminster Parliament, or the ones who will be elected next year in the general election? You know, it's a huge grey area filled with risk and no great certainties at all. But the Scottish people are going to have to face the fact that they take a decision which, irrespective of the negotiations, will bind them. And I think most of them will find that to be profoundly unsatisfactory and quite possibly frightening.
But why shouldn't they have a second? I mean, why shouldn't they know now that they will have a second bite at the cherry or a second vote, that this will be essentially a vote to give Edinburgh a mandate to negotiate independence, but then they would have a final say in whatever the terms of that independence would be?
Well, that might be a logical argument, but it's not what is being proposed at the moment. And certainly the Nationalists have resisted it, and David Cameron signed up to one decision being taken. So people will have to face that fact that there will be complete uncertainty on some of the critical areas that will face the Scots after the 18th of September.
Let me turn to one of the topics that gets a lot of attention here in the United States, which is the question of the nuclear deterrent and Trident, and you spoke a bit about this in your speech. My understanding is all of Britain's nuclear weapons are based in Scotland. We've heard different ideas floated that if there was Scottish independence, that London would try to negotiate basing rights in Scotland. That's one option. But are there other? What you, as a former defence secretary and as head of NATO, what are some of the other options that will be available to the rest of the UK to ensure the credibility and survivability of the independent deterrent going forward?
Well, all of the options would be very, very, very expensive. You know, it is not as if the deterrent was based at Fastlane and the Clyde as a punishment for Scotland. It is because it happens to have the characteristics that are required both for the docking of the submarines and for the storage of the missiles. And it's not easy to see an alternative place for that. And that's why I say, effectively, it might mean the unilateral nuclear disarming of the remainder of the United Kingdom. Now, you know, that should worry a lot of people for its effect on global balances. But it's proclaimed by the Scottish Nationalists. You know, they see that as one of the benefits of Scottish independence, that they indirectly would be disarming another country. So they've ruled out the possibility of a sovereign base. They've ruled out the possibility, dare I say it, of a Sevastopol-type agreement. They've simply said that within the lifetime of one parliament, then they expect to see the whole base eliminated from the nuclear site. They claim it'll become their major joint headquarters. But you know, at the present moment, 8,000 people are employed at Fastlane. You know, no conventional capability is likely to employ anything like that number in the future. But, you know, I was concentrating tonight on the geostrategic implications of them disarming another country.
But my understanding is there are some, over the long term, there may be some alternative bases, you know, in England, but it would be very expensive to move it. I mean, what would the... Is it the case that there are some sort of alternative options to preserve the deterrent if the new Scottish government insisted on no basing agreement, or is the choice really between a basing agreement and unilateral disarmament?
Well, it's difficult. There might be options, but it could be that they would be so expensive to be prohibitive. You know, I dare say at some price there could be, and that would have to be looked at in the extremity of the decision having been taken. But you know, that is not a preoccupation of the nationalists, despite the fact that we have opinion poll information to suggest that opinion in Scotland about the nuclear deterrent is not actually greatly different to public opinion south of the border. But it is among certain elites who are determined that they're going to pursue this this by any means that is possible.
In your speech too, you talked about British membership of different international organisations. Britain is obviously a permanent member, one of five, in the UN Security Council. Do you think that Scottish independence would in any way undermine the legitimacy of the UK's claim on a permanent seat, that the UK would be somehow a less legitimate permanent member if it lost, you know, 5 million people, 10% of its GNP, some of its military power?
Well, there'll certainly be some people who will use that as an argument. You know, there is a constant cry from Germany, from India, from Brazil, other countries, that the permanent membership of the Security Council reflects, you know, a period in the past that is long gone, and it must be changed. You know, that has always been resisted. It's been regarded as something that would open too many cans of worms, so nothing has happened up to now. But we're approaching the point where a new Secretary General of the UN has to be appointed, and that's always a time where, you know, the UN looks at itself to see if it's manageable for the future. And you know, the credibility of the continuing United Kingdom would undoubtedly be questioned, many cases by people who have been questioning it up to now.
Can I ask you about the European Union? We've heard a lot in this campaign about Scottish membership of the European Union and whether or not it will be automatic. It seems to me that both sides have it a little bit wrong in a way, in that, you know, Scotland, of course, would not be given automatic membership, but if it fills many of the criteria, it would be hard even for the Spanish government to object if they wanted to apply like any other state. But at the same time, Scotland's terms of membership with the current EU are really based on the agreement that Britain as a whole got in terms of opt-out, of the euro. Most all accession states have to agree to adopt the euro at some point in the future. There's a series of other concessions that the UK has at the moment that Scotland may not get. What's your assessment of where an independent Scotland would fit in into Europe? I mean, would Scotland benefit in a way from being an ordinary member of the EU, or does it need these sort of special agreements that, I mean, some of which you opposed or Labour opposed while in government, that the Tories had negotiated? And what were the terms of Scotland's relationship with Europe be?
Well, I think the key thing is that they want to negotiate. You're in a situation where the independent Scottish states said, we are already members of the European Union. We satisfy all of the criteria and we subscribe to all of the acquis. We want to be accepted, you know, on that basis. Then, you know, that would be completely different to a situation where it is being said by the current Scottish government that they want to negotiate Schengen, they want to negotiate the opt-out from Schengen, the border-free Europe, they want to opt out of the euro and the condition laying down that new states must be in the euro. They want to renegotiate the common fisheries policy to somehow advantage Scotland and the common elements of the common agricultural policy. And they want to share in the wild, the rather contentious subject of the British rebate, which tries to equalise out the contribution of the United Kingdom. So each of these things is a negotiation. So you don't start off from saying, you know, we expect to be taken as we are, because we're already members. And a negotiation means give and take. Now, I know a little bit about negotiation. I was once a trade union negotiator in the Scotch whisky industry, as it happened. And I was also a negotiator about NATO enlargement up to the 2002 NATO summit. So I was negotiating with seven countries, you know, who used to be in the Warsaw Pact and three of whom used to be in the members of the Soviet Union. And they had to pass certain tests in order to become NATO members. And there were certain conditions that if some of them had not satisfied, they would not have got into NATO, nor would they have got into the European Union. So a negotiation means give and take. It means accepting things sometimes that are not convenient or politic or popular. So therefore, any negotiation is going to be difficult. And it will involve 28 other countries saying yes or no, or saying we want a little bit of that and a little bit of this. So Spain, you know, at very worst could say no because it would mean an open door for their breakaway regions. But they don't have to do that. You know, the Spanish have got a wonderful record in practically every other enlargement negotiation of coming in at the last minute with a demand that is usually acceded to. So what if your negotiation on the common fisheries policy led to you having territorial waters that were half a mile instead of 26 miles? So, you know, it's not, all I'm saying is that it should not be taken for granted that it will be simple or uncomplicated or quick in order to get in. But obviously you would want to be in because that's the access to the single market, to the level playing field, and to all of the other aspects of the European Union that are so valuable.
Thank you. I read when I was reading over your articles over the weekend, I read in one that you said that you talked to members of the Defence Forces and that many of them would not want to join. I can't remember quite what the phrase was, but it was basically a subpar army with no expeditionary capability, and that they would stay in the British military. You, of course, have been a senior politician from Scotland serving in the British government, and you would know, I'm sure, many senior civil servants and politicians and business leaders from Scotland working in England. And so my question is, if there is an independence, a vote for independence, afterwards, how many of those people who are active, either at senior levels in the British government or the British military, how many of them will go to work for a Scottish government and move from the British military to the Scottish military or from the British government to the Scottish government, and how many of them would stay, you know, where they are and basically continue to work for the UK. I mean, what and can you talk us to us a little bit about maybe the internal angst or just divided loyalties that may arise in that situation? Because it is sort of unprecedented that you would have, you know, a country as in many ways as advanced on the government side as Britain, with such an integrated sort of system in the foreign policy and military policy, having this sort of dilemma. And at one level, it's a state decision, but at another, it's very personal, you know, for individuals and people trying to make up their minds. So what would that be like?
Well, it's difficult to project it forward. I've certainly spoken to many members of the British Army in the regiments that are going to be amputated from the British Army if the SNP get its way. Because all of the regiments that have got Scottish in their name, despite the fact that many of them are stationed in England or elsewhere, are going to be basically adopted by the existing Scottish regiments. They're going to reinstate the old Scottish regiments as well, which is a bit bizarre given the size of the army they're going to have. But the Scots Guards, which is part of the Brigade of Guards based in London, and the Royal Scots Dragoon Guards, which is a tank regiment, are all going to be sort of preemptively moved. But I've spoken to a lot of the ordinary soldiers who say absolutely no way. You didn't join the army in order to sort of become part of some tiny territorial defence force. I've only met one member of the British Armed Forces who I've asked, who said he might be tempted, but he was a captain in the Royal Navy and he thought he might be the first Sea Lord in Scotland. So he's about the only one that's the case. In terms of others, you know, well, you know, we move backwards and forwards all of the time. One of our great distinguished UK broadcasters is sitting at the back of this hall tonight, and he spends half his week now leading the Good Morning Scotland programme in Scotland, and the other part, you know, the BBC's huge flagship Today programme from London. We move effortlessly about, and that's one of the great advantages of the United Kingdom. To force people to make decisions would be pretty agonising.
That's in the private. I mean, it's a little bit of a different question, though, at the government, civil service, military level, right? Because there you would have to choose. You couldn't just go back and forth. Right, I mean, you could, obviously, if you worked for a broadcaster or a company, you could move back and forth.
Well, no, because they're going to set up a Scottish Broadcasting Corporation. They're not going to. Then people may buy a subscription, as they do in Ireland, to watch the BBC and to watch the favourite programmes. These favourite programmes all appear in the white paper and in the glossary of the nationalists. You know, you can still watch EastEnders and Coronation Street if that means anything
vital,
to people here.
Vital issue.
But well, actually more vital sometimes
than the
huge issues, you know. But that's why it's all, you know, on one hand, everything will remain the same. Still have the pound, we'll still have the Queen, we'll still be in Europe, we'll still be in NATO, you'll still watch Coronation Street and EastEnders. And on the other hand, you're going to be an independent Scottish state and you're going to stride the world as a great peacekeeping force and keeping out of adventures like Iraq. So that's the sales pitch. But when it boils down to it, people, Scots who are in England, you know, will be living in a foreign country. Defence companies in Scotland will find that their market is in a foreign country and that foreign country is not necessarily going to buy warships or equipment from factories that are in what will be a foreign country. And I think, you know, industry in Scotland is beginning to be more noisy about the implications of that and bringing a border. Borders, however soft they are borders. And borders create costs and they create tensions and they create problems. So there will be personal, commercial, industrial, social. All these things will be there. Whereas, you know, the Britishness is real. It's tangible. In the Commonwealth Games, there will be Scots this time running and cycling and jumping as Scots. when they were in Team GB at the moment. But most of the champions in the Olympics, you know, who were Scots, either live in England or trained in England or were part of, you know, the sporting family that got the concentration of effort that actually led to the medals being created. So there is a good UK narrative, even if it's not heard all that much.
We'll go, I think, to the audience in a couple of minutes, but I wanted to ask you just a couple of questions before we do. And one is on the role of America. So you're here in Washington, and you mentioned that there are others here talking about the same issue this week. I think it was about 18 months ago that the Obama administration intervened in the UK debate on membership of the European Union. The then Assistant Secretary for Europe made a statement that the US opposed Britain leaving the European Union, and then a few months later, President Obama made some remark that the European Union was stronger with Britain in it. And as I'm sure you're aware, this created some controversy in the UK and with some of the press saying that the US should basically stay out of it. My question is, should the United States, do you believe that the Obama administration ought to intervene in the debate on Scottish independence? If it's going to be as bad for the rest of the world and for the US, as you say, should he make a statement, or should there be an expression of you know, of the value of the union? And then a related question is, how much of the, obviously, the recent events in Crimea and elsewhere, impact somewhat indirectly on the referendum. So to what extent are Scottish voters likely to be swayed by the external environment? Will what goes on elsewhere or what others say or how they view the referendum matter at all to how they vote, or is it purely sort of an internal issue where the issues are everything from Trident to EastEnders to Texas?
Well, yeah, it's a good question, because there are people who say that the outside world should leave internal politics alone. But that, I think, only applies if the decision that is being taken has no relevance or no interest outside of it. You know, when the statement was made by a State Department official about Britain's membership of the European Union, it became controversial because the people who want to withdraw from the European Union thought that it was controversial. If he'd said, we'd be quite happy to see Britain outside of the European Union, these people would have cheered and would have quoted it and would have used it. So I don't think you should assume that just because one side of an argument screams and shouts that it's interference, you know, that is a preclusion to saying it. You know, this decision, as I've said tonight, has huge repercussions outside of the United Kingdom. You know, we are, you know, the second military power in the West. You know, we are a big and a powerful influence in the West. And this is a moment in time, a particular moment in time. It's not the only moment in time when the solidarity and the solidity and the stability of the West actually matters for all of us. And therefore, for people to say, whether they are pop stars like David Bowie or other, you know, football managers like Alec Ferguson, to say we want the United Kingdom to stay together, doesn't seem to me to be in any way controversial, because it affects everyone else. For the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom to say it, for other foreign people to weigh up the implications for them and to say we'd rather see Scotland remaining part of the United Kingdom seems to me entirely uncontentious and actually quite necessary if they feel that their interest and the stability of the world is going to be affected. But of course, if anybody says it, if President Obama says that, anybody else said it, the Scottish nationalists will go berserk. They will create a fuss. They will say, stay out of Scottish affairs.
But would you like, I mean, obviously you don't mind if they go berserk, because, you know, you've been trying hard to argue against them. So would you like the US to take a stance? Would you call basically on the administration to say, you know, what its view is in the referendum, or do you prefer them to remain silent between now and September?
I think Britain's allies need to speak out. I think they need to sort of say this affects them as well, that this is not purely a domestic matter, even although it is a decision that will be taken by the Scottish people. The Scottish people need to be conscious that they're taking a decision not just for themselves and for future generations in a one-off vote, but that it also has an effect elsewhere. And people who are affected or think they will be affected have every right to speak out. So I'm not telling foreign governments to do it, but I think people should examine carefully what the fallout would be from that decision. And if it affects them or they feel it affects them, I think that they should certainly say it. We live in a very, very integrated world, and when you get a situation like the annexation of Crimea, which is part of Ukraine and annexed by Russia, people are right to feel outraged at that. And the outside world has been utterly vocal. Let me just quote you something. I stood on a platform beside Vladimir Putin on the 28th of May 2002 in Rome at the inaugural meeting of the NATO-Russia Council. And a journalist in the audience asked a question, and President Putin replied to that question. So these words that I'm going to read out were said by President Putin, not from a script, but, him spontaneously talking. He said, "Russia always had a crucial role in world affairs. The problem for our country has been, however, that over a very long period of time, a situation arose in which Russia was on one side and the other side was practically the whole of the rest of the world. Nothing good came of that confrontation between us and the rest of the world. We certainly gained nothing from it." Now, that was, 12 years ago. But it's interesting that that was President Putin's view. And yet, again, he's now found himself in that particular position. But it was right for the rest of the world to express a view about what happened. And it is equally right, despite the fact that the decision in Scotland will be taken democratically and will be taken within the context of an agreement with the UK government, that if people feel that it's going to affect the stability of the world, that they should speak out.
Great, thank you. We'll go to the audience now for questions. So we have a microphone, do we, at the back? So the gentleman just right at the back, beside where you are. Yeah,
thank you.
And if you could just introduce yourselves and then ask a question.
I'm Mike Haltzell from Johns Hopkins SAIS. Thank you, Lord Robertson, for a terrific presentation. I'd like to continue on this international vein and ask your question about what looks like the sort of a surge in populism in many, perhaps most countries of the European Union. Not only fringe parties, but if you look at the results from the Hungarian national elections yesterday, or even UKIP in the United Kingdom. Many observers think that next month in the elections to the EU Parliament, something like a quarter of the delegates who are elected, the representatives elected, may be essentially anti-EU. If this happens, and I think it is likely, I'm just wondering, what do you speculate the effect of this rising populist tide, so to speak, would have on the voters of Scotland? Would this be seen as eroding the EU and hence a bad thing or a good thing? And how does UKIP, if at all, factor into this?
Well, I think so UKIP is another manifestation, I think, of people's disillusionment with politics. And that's not unique to the United Kingdom or to Europe as well. The Tea Party in this country has has been a manifestation of a disagreement or a disillusionment with politics as normal. I think we're beginning to see that. You're seeing a much more violent reaction to politics as usual in some European countries, where austerity arising out of the Eurozone crisis has produced some pretty nasty new factors in the way things are going. So will it affect the Scottish referendum? I don't think so. UKIP has got virtually no toehold in Scotland. It's You know, the Scottish National Party rose on a sort of tide of populism, you know, on a plague on both houses. And, you know, their good result that gave them an overall majority in the last Scottish elections, despite the fact that they only got 45% of the vote, was largely occasioned with a disillusionment with the then coalition of Labour and Liberal Democrats in the Scottish Parliament. So they've sort of mopped up the anti-politics vote as it stands at the present moment, and they still retain a degree of residual of popularity there. So I don't think that's going to affect Scotland very much. But it can certainly affect the European Union as a whole, because people right across Europe don't seem to think that the European Parliament elections matter very much. You're not voting for prime ministers, you're not voting for governments, therefore you can indulge your disillusionment with conventional politics by voting. The only problem is that the Lisbon Treaty and the Maastricht Treaty have all invested in the European Parliament very, very significant new powers, both to initiate and to block legislation. So if these parties are going to have a dominant role in the European Parliament, that's going to have a detrimental effect on the way in which the European Union functions. And that really would be very distressing and, I think, disturbing as well.
Great, thank you. Next question. So the lady there on the right-hand side.
My name is Tracy Johnston, and I just wanted to say the Trident issue always is at the forefront of all these conversations, but I know that there are folks in Groton, Connecticut, Hampton Roads, Virginia, and St. Mary's, Georgia that would love to have those 8,000 jobs. I'm just fascinated where you might have an error. Say, no, we don't want the 8,000 jobs. I mean, when the rubber hits the road, is that really the way they want to go?
Well, no, they pretend that the jobs will stay because they say they will put the conventional navy and they will put the mines, the mine sweepers and the fishery protection vessels will all be in fast lane and that will protect all of the jobs. That isn't credible. It may not even be truthful, but that's the pitch that they put forward, and they play on an emotionalism about Trident and weapons of mass destruction. Now, interestingly enough, although the Labour Party did very badly in the Scottish Parliament elections, the one constituency seat where we did particularly well was the one that included the bulk of the fast lane workers, you know, so in that locality it matters. And it may well be closer to the day, you know, the fantasy put forward about all of these jobs being protected will actually disperse, as it will be for a lot of the other defence jobs that are critical in the UK context.
It was bad publicity when a student ran around off of fast lane there. So
okay,
that
well,
no, it didn't. No, the missile submarines have never run aground anywhere. The HMS Astute, which is a nuclear-powered submarine, went aground off the island of Skye due to a mishap at that point. But American submarines have also got a tendency to hit things, bash things, and go aground. And they've on average got a better record for not bashing into things than the average automobile has, I would have thought.
Okay. Next question. We'll take this woman up the front, please. Just up the front, second row. Thank you.
Thank you, Lord Robertson, very much for being here. I'm Lucy Getman, American University. I wondered if you could shine a gender lens on some of your analysis. For example, is there a gender gap in the level of support or opposition to the movement? And if so, are there particular issues where this particularly shows itself, such as those we've discussed this afternoon? And finally, are the various campaigns, pro and anti, responding to a gender gap, if there is one, and if so, how are they doing it?
It's interesting you should say it. The polls seem to suggest that women are less inclined to go for independence, more wary about the cost. And that it is men who largely favour it. So there is a gender gap. The deputy leader of the Scottish National Party, Nicola Sturgeon, is in the forefront of the campaign, pushed there by the leader of the SNP, who many people, it is said, regard as being a bit too macho for the female vote. And they've also produced a childcare strategy in their white paper. It's actually nothing to do with independence. You know, they've got the powers to implement a childcare strategy at the moment in the Scottish Parliament, but that's, they say, is one of the benefits of having a separate Scottish state, and that's been clearly included in order to deal with that gender gap. The leader of the Scottish Labour Party is a woman, and the leader of the Scottish Conservative Party is a woman, so, you know, there's no lack of gender politics in Scotland.
Great, thanks. Next question, this gentleman here on the left side.
Hello, my name is Stephen Wallace from the Defence Department. Could you in your comments about the SNP's nuclear policies, you were sort of implying that they're inconsistent with NATO membership aspirations. How then do they differ from the policies that were adopted by Iceland and Denmark, and how would the situation of Scotland be different from those countries?
There are countries in NATO that don't have nuclear weapons on their soil. That is true. All of the countries in NATO, the 28 countries, accept the nuclear umbrella. They accept the strategic concept, which lays down that as long as nuclear weapons exist, then NATO will remain a nuclear alliance. So there's quite a clear differentiation between countries like Norway and Iceland, who don't have nuclear weapons on their territory, but do accept the role of nuclear weapons inside the alliance. So, it is manifestly different to have a country that now says that it will be anti-nuclear, not just non-nuclear, and is willing to expel, a nuclear weapons base, from a neighbouring country, and therefore, sort of remove it from the NATO harmony. Because the British independent nuclear deterrent and the French deterrent are both mentioned in the strategic concept as part and parcel of NATO's armoury.
Great, thank you. This gentleman here in the tie, just at the
Thanks. My name is Jaime Velasco, and I am a student at George Washington University. Well, I'm Spanish from Madrid, and I want to ask you something about the national independence process in Catalonia. There is some consensus that the process hasn't been conducted very well on the part of the Spanish government. There hasn't been a response on part of the Spanish government to the Catalonian question, as they call it. Now, I want to ask you, even though the Scottish process and the Catalonian process are certainly different, what would you have to say about it, and what would you have to say about how to conduct that process if you were to talk to any Spanish government official? Thank you.
Well, I believe in keeping our union together, so I can see why the Spanish government takes the position that it does. And the Spanish constitution that was subscribed to by all parts of Spain after Franco makes it quite clear that, that breakaways are not permissible. As I say, this country fought a war in order to stop a breakaway taking place, however much the southern states had themselves wanted it at that time. So, I'm not in a position to advise the Spanish government in terms of devolution within Spain. It's a very unique constitution. Where I think the Scottish government find it difficult is that they try all the time to say that they are entirely different to Spain. That Scotland was an independent country up until 1707. That it's got its own symbols of nationhood. It was a nation in its own right. And these guys are all sort of fakes, and they're making their case, completely differently. And again, it sort of ignores history as well. But I think a lot of the genies can be kept in the lamp so long as Scotland remains inside the United Kingdom. And I think the idea that you balkanize the whole of Europe at a time when globalization and interdependence is so important would be the wrong direction for history.
Great. Okay, this gentleman here. Yep. Thanks.
Hello, I'm Mark Brodsky. I'm a United States citizen. So here's my question. Here we always look for the money in political campaigns. So who's funding the yes and no campaigns?
The Yes campaign has received very substantial amounts of money from a handful of individuals. Edwin Muir, the poet laureate of Scotland, died 3 years ago and left £1 million to the Scottish Nationalists. A couple of people who live in Ayrshire in the west of Scotland won, I think, £64 million in the Euro lottery, and they happen to be sympathisers of the Scottish National Party, and it is well publicised that they have given a couple of million pounds to the SNP, and may, it is rumoured, be going to give them more. And there have been some other individuals who seem to be in that fortunate position as well to do that. The No campaign has largely had small contributions. All of this is published, so you know everyone knows there's no PACs in Scotland. There's no way of hiding. Every donation over £5,000 has got to be declared, and it's got to be cut somebody from the United Kingdom that gives that as well. But the Yes campaign is at the moment, you know, massively outspending the No campaign.
Why is that? Why? I mean, there's obviously lots of people with money who would support the No campaign, not just in Scotland but elsewhere. Why aren't they donating money?
Well, there was one businessman who gave £500,000 and then found himself at the end of a pretty vicious, unrestrained targeting of him and his interests. And I think that, you know, that particular campaign put off a number of other people who might have been willing to do it.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. So we'll take these two gentlemen here, but the gentleman there first.
My name is Jerry Livingston, and full disclosure, I'm Scottish lineage, and my family came over here the 17th century and helped in New York State from McDougall to free our states from Britain. My question relates to a country that was much involved in those days and attitudes of France toward the possibility of Scottish independence. France helped the Scottish cause in the past, and France helped the United States cause as well. I just wonder whether you anticipate any stance being taken by France on this issue.
And we might take the second one together as well, so this gentleman here as well.
Thank you, Gerald Chandler. Would you go into some more detail about the contributions of small European countries to NATO, particularly if we get additional independence in Catalonia, if Belgium breaks up? Would they make any be treated any differently than, say, Lithuania or Denmark or other small countries? And are all of the ones that are currently members of NATO making a big contribution comparable to their size?
Some of them make a contribution that is disproportionate to their size. Estonia, I think, has been seen as being the biggest contributor to Afghanistan, you know, given the size of that country. So, but you know, again, we're talking about scale here as well. I wouldn't anticipate there would be any problem related to the size, although the fragmentation of countries and therefore the scale of the effort that can be given, you know, is going to be very different depending on what the size is going to be and what the capabilities would be. The design of the Scottish Armed Forces, as outlined by this manifesto masquerading as a white paper, you know, suggests that they're not going to be making contributions of any great size at all, and certainly nothing compared to the contributions that the present United Kingdom is able to do. And in relation to France, I haven't a clue. I don't know the answer to that question at all. I'm sure there are private views, and there may well be public views expressed in the near future. But we won't go into the history of French involvement in the American War of Independence, which...
okay, just up here at the front. Yep.
Thank you. Tim Oliver from the Center for Transatlantic Relations at SAIS. One country you've not mentioned but which connects to France is Quebec and the implications of Quebec nationalism. And really thinking with regard to Scotland, as we've seen, even though there have been referendums there where they've rejected independence, this comes back and back and back. And therefore my question is, can the Scottish question, if we can call it that, be answered through a referendum? Or will it just come back in about 20 years' time if they say no?
The nationalists have said yes, they're going to bring it back. Whether they'll be able to do is another matter. And that depends very much on the outcome. If it's 51-49 or 50.5 to 49.5, as it nearly was in Quebec, that might make it more certain that it would come back. I was talking to somebody the other day and speculating as to what Mr. Salmond would say if I said I won't accept 51-49 in favour of a yes vote, and that I will continue to campaign through the general election next year and the Scottish elections in 2016 to overturn the vote that was taken there. I can imagine that the abuse that I normally get would be increased dramatically in volume if I did. But, you know, I would like to think that the Scottish people will make a decision that will relegate that position for a very long time indeed. It's sort of come out, you know, the support for independence has rarely been above 30%. Over all of the years that the SNP have been campaigning, and even in the 5 years that they've actually been in government, it's only in the last few months that the picture has started to change a little bit about that. But the residual figure has been 27-30%. So if it's 70-30 at the end of the day, I think that should put the argument to rest. I think by and large, people, a 2.5 year campaign, I can tell you, has tested the resilience.
That's the norm here. It's like, it's the norm here in the US.
Well, but it's not ours. We have 3 week general election campaigns, you know, and 2.5 years has, I think, punished people. You know, our pain threshold is actually quite low when it comes to politics, you know, and I think people are pretty fed up with it. I think, you know, they'll gradually, as we get closer to September, pay more and more attention to some of the intangibles, some of the imponderables, you know, and what it actually means. It means to them, and I hope that therefore the constitutional question will be put in the back burner. If it's a no vote, then there are new powers that are going to go to the Scottish Parliament anyway. That's part of the consensus that has been developed during that campaign, and that will answer a number of the discontent elements that have appeared in Scotland. But I think, frankly, 70-30 would certainly put it to bed. If there were nationalists in this audience tonight, I would be reminded of something that I said when I was the Shadow Secretary of State for Scotland, when I said that devolution will kill the Scottish nationalists stone dead. Now, this is repeated time upon time.
I didn't bring it up, though.
Did you not? No, well, that's why I'm bringing it up, because I've yet to be proved wrong. We'll see. Time will tell.
You mean that it will ultimately kill it? That the reason there's not Scottish independence is because there is devolution, or yeah?
Well, a good journalist in Scotland who has declared himself for a yes vote recently wrote an article saying that George Robertson was right, that what is stopping people going for independence is the fact that we've got devolution and we've got a Scottish Parliament, and it's got substantial powers. I think at the end of the day, I think it will do for independence. If the nationalists continue, they will be a party of devolution, mm-hmm, and not a party of separation.
Okay, we're going to take we have a bunch of hands, so I'm going to take a few together, and then you can answer whichever you like, because we've got about 6 minutes left. So got the two women here on the right-hand side, and a gentleman in the back, and then a woman over here. So if you could all just very briefly ask a question.
Thank you. Jen Bates, British citizen and supporter of the Better Together campaign. I'd like to ask you, what would be the impact of a split on the economy, both of the UK and Scotland?
Okay, thank you. Just over here.
My name is Kay Winning. I work at the World Bank. I'm from East Kilbride, which is a small town nearby where you're from. I have a question somewhat related
to... Quite a big town, actually.
Quite a big town, the largest town in Scotland, which is only 100,000 people. I have a question somewhat around the economy. It relates to the subsidies. I studied law at the time when the EU was coming together, 1999, we were integrating. And now I see sort of start to separate. I'm just curious, that Scotland joining as an independent member after countries like Estonia, Latvia, is that going to be detrimental to Scotland? And also in terms of the subsidies from London, losing them, what you think the impact of that will be?
Okay, I think we have two more. So the gentleman down the very back.
Thank you. My name is Hermes Levy. I'm from the Occupy Wall Street. You have mentioned, Lord, the Tea Party, but there was also here a movement called the Occupy Movement that birthed in more than 1,000 of cities in the U.S. and throughout the world, including in the United Kingdom. This movement was fought, but if you think about it, it was born on September 17th, just like a specific date in the American Revolution. This Scottish referendum is in September 18. For the people who are initiated, it's meaningful. What do you think about the view according to which this is just another attack against the Western population, including if you consider the economical crisis, the budget reduction, the defense reduction, and all of this, but made at a subtle level that people cannot really understand.
Thank you. And then one more over here. Were you as well? Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Tara Orton, and I actually wrote my senior thesis on Scottish secession, so that's my interest here. I actually had two very quick questions, one geopolitical, one domestic. Geopolitically, I was surprised to not hear any mention of the North Sea oil and how you think the fallout over negotiations there will impact national security for, an independent Scotland or the UK if it remains as one nation. And domestically, it seems like the SNP has built up a very strong narrative of Westminster not understanding Scotland, but with, the bedroom tax, et cetera. And I was wondering if there was anything that Westminster you feel could do to... in terms of policy, create a stronger argument for, its ability to relate to Scotland and prevent that sort of misunderstanding from becoming a talking point for the SNP.
Okay, thanks. There's a lot on the table there. Obviously, we've only got a couple of minutes, so don't feel the need to go through each, but more to give you a sense of what everyone is thinking, if you just want to make some general comments and choose whichever you'd like to answer.
I think the effect on the economy in Scotland could be quite substantial. If you'd like an objective account of that, then the Weir Group, which is one of Scotland's biggest engineering companies, I serve on the board, so I declare an interest. But we commission a study by Oxford Economics, one of the most respected consultancies, into the economic impact of independence in Scotland. It's on the Weir Group website, and it's worth reading because in detail and quite objectively it goes over the uncertainties, the intangibles and the certainties involved as well, and comes to a pretty strong conclusion. And there's a lot of industries in Scotland that basically depend on markets south of the border. Standard Life is a big insurance company based in Scotland, employing something like 2,500 people. 90% of its customers are south of the border. So they would be in a foreign country, and they've said that they've now had to put contingency plans into place for registering south of the border because that's where the customers are. And if you take British BAE Systems, who build warships for what would be a foreign country, the other big defence industries as well, there could be a big impact. In terms of subsidies from London, in terms of identifiable public expenditure, Scotland has a higher payments than they do south of the border. But actually, if you take North Sea oil, these figures are not terribly convincing in any event as to, in terms of subsidies given the nature of Scotland. But, you know, some of the recent studies that have come out have made it absolutely clear that the deficit with England would be covered by North Sea oil, which would leave practically nothing else, you know, for the oil fund that is going to pay for so many other things as well. So it simply equalised the balance sheet as it stands at the present moment. North Sea oil, I didn't mention, but that's another area where the negotiations would be difficult and they would be fraught. Because although there is a standard definition as to where the continental shelf is and where the dividing line would be, that presupposes that everybody accepts it. And given the importance of the oil fields and of oil to the economy, it is not a given that everyone would think that this was a wonderful way of dealing with it. It's another area of negotiation that would be involved in that. And, you know, among those who would be negotiating would be Scottish MPs who happen to be in the present government at the moment. And although the narrative, as you quite rightly say, is, you know, they don't understand us in England, you know, we don't get the government that we vote for, that actually doesn't apply in every election. When Tony Blair won and I became Secretary of State for Defence, England didn't get the government that it wanted. So, you know, Scottish MPs can often make the difference that is involved in that. No, I'm wrong on that, actually. We did in that election. In other elections, Scottish votes have accounted for that as well. But, there, you know, there is a coalition at the present moment. A lot of us disagree with some of the things that they are actually doing. But you should always remember that in the election, the Scottish election, the Scottish National Party got 45% of the vote. So 55% of the Scottish population who voted didn't get the government they chose. And given that only half the electorate voted, actually only 22% of those eligible to vote in Scotland actually voted for the Scottish National Party. So it's a slightly dangerous double-edged sword argument to say that you didn't get the government you voted for and therefore you should change the whole constitution in order to create a country in which you might get the government that was closer to what you wanted.
Great.
It's a bit of a skim across.
Yeah, no, perfect. Lord Robson, thank you so much for this really wonderful speech and conversation afterwards. We very much look forward to holding more events on the Scottish referendum between now and September and then, of course, afterwards as well. And we hope to have you back on future occasions when you're back in Washington to talk about this, but also Ukraine and NATO-related issues as well. I'd like to thank you all for coming. And with that, we're adjourned. Thank you.